Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. Today on the program, Jill Robbins brings us Ask a Teacher. You'll also hear reports from Brian Lynn and me. And we'll close the show with an American story. But first, here's Brian Lynn.
It has been nearly 5 years since a Malaysian passenger airplane was shot down over Ukraine. A missile brought down Malaysia Airlines flight MH17, killing all its 298 passengers and crew. Investigators found that a missile was launched from territory controlled by pro-Russian rebels in eastern Ukraine. The crash led to calls for better international methods for sharing information about dangerous conflict areas to prevent similar tragedies. But many industry experts say more improvements are still needed. The issue was recently discussed at a conference of the International Air Transport Association in Seoul, the South Korean capital. Gilberto Lopez Meyer is the association's senior vice president for safety and flight operations. He told the Reuters news agency there is a clear need for better ways to collect and share information about airspace over conflict areas. Lopez Meyer noted that currently airline companies often use different information to judge which areas present the greatest flying risks. He added that airlines spend millions of dollars a year on extra fuel to fly around parts of the Middle East and Africa to avoid conflict areas. Some carriers choose to fly over war-torn countries, while others do not. This was the case at the time of the MH17 crash. In addition to Malaysia Airlines, Lufthansa and Singapore Airlines were also flying aircraft over eastern Ukraine. But British Airways and Air France had avoided the area. Isham Ismail is the head of Malaysia Airlines. He told Reuters the downing of MH17 led his company to approve new safety measures. "The wound is still here in the whole organization, and we take safety very seriously," he said. After the MH17 incident, the airline industry backed creation of a United Nations-supported website. The site was supposed to provide the latest information on conflict zones to help carriers, but it later closed because of disputes among nations over how the information should be shared. When this happened, some airlines did not know where to turn for help. Mark Zee is the founder of Ops Group, which launched a free website called Safe Airspace to provide guidance to airlines after MH17. For the big 50 airlines, they have the resources to dedicate a security department to the job, Zee said. "For everyone else, and that is thousands of operators, I can tell you that many of them have a really hard time making a decent risk assessment. I see it in the emails we get every day," Zee said. One example is Qatar Airways, which recently decided to send its aircraft over Syria. Disputes between Qatar and some of its neighbors had blocked the airline from using other nations' airspace. Qatar Airways chief Akbar Al-Bakar said the company would not fly anywhere that is not safe. The United States and other countries banned their airlines from flying over Syrian airspace because of safety risks, notes a website operated by the European Union Aviation Safety Agency. The Dutch Safety Board led the investigation into the downing of the Malaysia Airlines plane. In a report in February, the group said the resources available to airlines often communicate changing threat levels too slowly to be useful. Mohammed Aziz is a former Lebanese air accident investigator. He now works with Aviation Strategies International, a private company which provides assistance to airlines. I think after MH17, people became more aware of the problem. They seek information, Aziz said. The problem is, before they weren't seeking information. They were waiting for information to come their way. The UN-assisted International Civil Aviation Organization has approved guidelines for air traffic service officials to report conflict dangers to pilots. But those rules are not set to take effect until November 2020.
The huge T-Rex skeleton bends over a large triceratops, lying on his side below. With its mouth wide open, the Tyrannosaurus Rex looks ready to kill his prey with a final, massive bite to the triceratops's neck. The display can be found at the National Museum of Natural History, part of the Smithsonian System in Washington, D.C. The museum has sought a massive Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton for many years. Before, it used a model of one. But museum director Kirk Johnson says that was never good enough. It's been kind of deeply embarrassing to be the National Museum and not have a T-Rex, he said. The T-Rex display is now the centerpiece of the museum's newest show, the David H. Koch Hall of Fossils Deep Time. It opens to the public June 8th. For Johnson, it is almost impossible to overstate the power and appeal of dinosaurs. Children are especially interested. Kids love dinosaurs in an almost pathological way, Johnson said, standing next to the remains of the top predator dinosaur. The museum just missed out on buying a T-Rex back in 1997, when an almost complete skeleton became available for sale. Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History won the purchase with a $7.6 million offer. That T-Rex is named Sue, after the fossil collector who found the bones in the American state of South Dakota. Officials at the Field Museum built a special area for the skeleton. It includes a gift store of all things Sue. The dinosaur even has her own Twitter account and a media presentation of her life story. Kirk Johnson's team in Washington is clearly looking to build a similar image for their own T-Rex. The The Smithsonian's new dinosaur came from the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana. The skeleton is smaller and less complete than Sue. The Army Corps of Engineers owned the bones because they were discovered on land that the federal agency controls in Montana. In 2014, the Smithsonian negotiated a 50-year contract for control of the skeleton. The Smithsonian employed a team of experts in Canada to put the bones together. The T-Rex was 12 meters long and weighed at least 3,600 kilograms as an adult. Its remains now stand at the center of the new exhibition site, along with many other dinosaur skeletons. Among them are huge mastodons, as well as prehistoric mammals the size of house cats. The museum show seeks to tell the history of the planet and its wildlife. In modern times, movies like Jurassic Park have helped grow dinosaur interest for a new generation of young fans. But such movies also represent the T-Rex as a mostly huge, stupid, and dangerous animal. Smaller velociraptors are presented as the true threat, quick, intelligent, and vicious hunters in groups. But the T-Rex still holds power in the public imagination as the highest predator.
This week, we answer a question we received in an email from Tina. She writes, "I just want to know how to use the words borrow and lend in a situation. Is it correct to say, 'Could you lend me a pen?' Or, 'Can I borrow your pen?' Thank you very much." These two words are a source of trouble for many English learners. The reason? They have about the same meaning, but each word's action goes in different directions. Borrow means to take something from another person, knowing you will give it back to them. Lend means to give something to another person, expecting to get it back. So the sentences you asked about are both correct. Your choice of borrow or lend depends on which direction is more important to you. Imagine yourself in the middle of the picture. Anything you borrow moves toward you. Things you lend go away from you. Notice that the prepositions that often follow the verbs are different. We borrow from someone, but we lend to someone. Let's say you and I go shopping, Tina. I need to sign my name on a receipt, but I do not have a pen. So I ask you, "Can I borrow a pen?" I chose borrow because I am thinking of the action as it relates to me. You are a good friend, so you lend me the pen. I forget it is yours, and I put it in my bag. Later, we meet a good friend, and she asks for your email address. You search in your bag, but no pen. You think, "I lent Jill my pen, and she didn't give it back to me." Now you are thinking of the action that you did. So you can ask me, "Jill, do you remember that pen I lent you? I need it now." I feel bad that I forgot to return the pen. I say, "Sorry, Tina, I forgot that I borrowed it. Here you are." Be careful. Personal pronouns like me, you, him, and others never come after the verb borrow. But it is correct to use them after lend, as in, lend me a dollar for some ice cream. I hope this helps you understand lend and borrow. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Jill Robbins.
Our story today is called Athenaïs. It was written by Kate Chopin. Here is Barbara Klein with the story.
Athenaïs went away one morning to visit her parents, 10 miles back on the Bon Dieu River in Louisiana. She did not return in the evening, and Cazot, her husband, was worried. Cazot expressed his worries to his servant, Félicité, who served him dinner. He ate alone by the light of a coal oil lamp. Félicité stood nearby like a restless shadow.
"Only married 2 months and she has her head turned already to leave? It is not right," she said.
Cazot shrugged his shoulders. Félicité's opinion of his wife's behavior after 2 months of marriage did not matter to him. He was used to being alone and did not mind a night or two of it. Cazot stood up and walked outside. The night was beginning to deepen and gather black around the groups of trees in the yard. Far away, he could hear the sound of someone playing an accordion. Nearby, a baby was crying. Cazot's horse was waiting, saddled. He still had much farm work to do before bedtime. He did not have time to think about Athenaïs, but he felt her absence like a deep pain. Before he slept that night, Cazot was visited by an image of Athenaïs' pale young face with its soft lips and sensual eyes. The marriage had been a mistake. He had only to look into her eyes to feel that, to sense her growing dislike of him. But the marriage could not be undone, and he was ready to make the best of it, and expected the same effort from her. These sad thoughts kept Cazot awake far into the night. The moon was shining, and its pale light reached into the room. It was still outside, with no sound except the distant notes of the accordion. Athenaïs did not return the next day, although her husband sent a message to do so through her brother, Monteclin. On the third day, Cazot prepared his horse and went himself in search of her. Athenaïs' parents, the Michets, lived in a large home owned by a trader who lived in town. The house was far too big for their use. Upstairs, the rooms were so large and empty that they were used for parties. A dance at the Michet home and a plate of Madame Michet's gumbo were pleasures not to be missed. Madame Michet was sitting on the porch outside the house. She stood up to greet Cazot. She was short and fat, with a cheery face, but she was clearly tense as Cazot arrived. Monteclin was there too, but he was not uneasy. He made no effort to hide his dislike of Cazot. "Dirty pig," he said under his breath as Cazot climbed the stairs to the porch. Monteclin disliked Cazot for refusing to lend him money long ago. Now that this man was his sister's husband, he disliked him even more. Michel and his oldest son were away. They both respected Cazot and talked highly of him. Cazot shook hands with Madame Michel, who offered him a chair. Athenaïs had shut herself in her room. "You know, nothing would do last night," Madame Michel said. "Athenaïs just had to stay for a little dance. The boys would not let their sister leave." Cazot shrugged his shoulders to show he knew nothing about last night. "Didn't Monteclin tell you we were going to keep Athenaïs?" she asked. But Monteclin had told him nothing. "And how about the night before?" asked Cazot. "And last night? Do you have dances every night?" Madame Michel laughed and told her son to go tell Athenaïs her husband had arrived. Monteclin did not move. "You know as well as I do that it is no use to tell Athenaïs anything," said Monteclin. "You and Pa have been talking to her since Monday. When Athenaïs said she was not returning to Cazot, she meant it." Two fiery red spots rose to Cazot's cheeks. What Monteclin said was true. Upon arriving home, Athenaïs had announced she was there to stay. It was difficult for her to understand why she had married. Girls were just expected to get married. And she did like Cazot. Monteclin had asked Athenaïs to explain herself. He had asked her if Cazot abused her or if he drank too much. "No," Athenaïs had said. "It is just being married that I hate. I do not like being Mrs. Cazot. I want to be Athenaïs Michel again. I do not like living with a man, all his clothing everywhere, and his ugly bare feet." At the time, Monteclin had been sorry his sister had no serious evidence to use against Cazot. And now there was Cazot himself looking like he wanted to hit Monteclin. Cazot stood up and went inside the house to his wife's room. "Athenaïs, get ready," he said quietly. "It is late and we do not have time to lose." Athenaïs was not prepared for his calm request. She felt a sense of hopelessness about continuing to rebel against the idea of marriage. She gathered her hat and gloves. Then she walked downstairs past her brother and mother, got on her horse, and rode away. Cazot followed behind her. It was late when they reached home. Cazot once more ate dinner alone. Athenaïs sat in her room crying. Athenaïs's parents had hoped that marriage would bring a sense of responsibility so deeply lacking in her character. No one could understand why she so hated her role as wife. Cazot had never spoken angrily to her, or called her names, or failed to give her everything she wanted. His main offense seemed to be that he loved her, and Athenaïs was not a woman to be loved against her will. At breakfast, Athenaïs complained to her husband.
Why did you have to marry me when there were so many other girls to choose from? She asked. And it is strange that if you hate my brother so much, why would you marry his sister?
I do not know what any of them have to do with it, Kazo said. I married you because I loved you. I guess I was fooled to think I could make you happy. I do not know what else to do but make the best of a bad deal and shake hands over it.
It now seemed to Atenaiz that her brother was the only friend left to her in the world. Her parents had turned from her, and her friends laughed at her. But Monteclin had an idea for securing his sister's freedom. After some thought, Atenaiz agreed to his plan. The next morning, Kazo woke up to find his wife was gone. She had packed her belongings and left in the night. Kazo felt a terrible sense of loss. It was not new. He had felt it for weeks. He realized he had missed his chance for happiness. He could not think of loving any other woman, and could not imagine Atenaiz ever caring for him. He wrote her a letter stating that he did not want her back unless she returned of her own free will. Atenaiz had escaped to the big city of New Orleans. She was staying at a private hotel that Monteclin had chosen and paid to rent for a month. A woman named Sylvie owned the hotel and took good care of Atenaiz. Atenaiz soon became friends with Mr. Gouvernail, who was also staying at the hotel. This friendship helped her feel less lonely about missing her family. But Mr. Gouvernail soon started to fall in love with Atenaiz. He knew she was uninformed, unsatisfied, and strong-willed, but he also suspected that she loved her husband, although she did not know it. Bitter as this belief was, he accepted it. Atenaiz's last week in the city was coming to an end. She had not found a job and was too homesick to stay any longer. Also, she had not been feeling well. She complained in detail about her sickness to Sylvie. Sylvie was very wise, and Atenaiz was very stupid. Sylvie very calmly explained to Atenaiz that she was feeling sick because she was pregnant. Atenaiz sat very still for a long time thinking about this new information. Her whole being was overcome with a wave of happiness. Then she stood up, ready to take action. She had to tell her mother, and Kazo. As she thought of him, a whole new sense of life swept over her. She could not wait to return to him. The next day, Atenaiz spent traveling home. When she arrived at Kazo's, he lifted her out of the horse carriage, and they held each other tight. The country night was warm and still, except for a baby crying in the distance. "Listen, Kazo," said Atenaiz, "how Juliet's baby is crying. Poor darling, I wonder what is the matter with it."
That's our show for today. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.